Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the raid today on Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen's Manhattan office and his room at the Loews Regency Hotel, where FBI agents seized privileged communications between Cohen and his clients and confiscated electronic equipment, emails, tax documents, and business records. A former FBI special agent, Michael German, who is now a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program at New York University, joins us to discuss the raid that was in part acting on a referral from Special Counsel Mueller, making it the second time only after the FBI raid on Paul Manafort that FBI agents were used to seize material instead of the usual practice of issuing subpoenas. We will assess how much this raid had to do with the Russia investigation because Trump's lawyer was mentioned prominently in the Steele dossier, or the case involving the second mortgage Michael Cohen took out on his home to pay $130,000 to a porn star a week before the election for no apparent reason, since his client Donald Trump insists it had nothing to do with him. Then we'll look into whether the bombs and missiles will fall on John Bolton's first day on the job in the White House or the next day, since Trump has promised that within 48 hours, those behind the latest chemical attack in Syria will, quote, have a big price to pay. Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy, joins us from Beirut to discuss the competing pressures on Trump from his new hawkish advisor and Trump's need to appear tough and not weak, like he accuses Obama of being, at the same time wanting to get the U.S. out of Syria and not wanting to offend Putin. Then finally, we will speak with Jeff Biggers, an award-winning journalist, historian, and playwright who joins us from Iowa, where the state legislature just passed a law criminalizing peaceful protest against oil and gas pipelines, punishable by up to 25 years in jail. He joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Iowa's anti-protest bill would make the Boston Tea Party as felons, and how the Koch brothers-backed bills through their front group, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, are already in the legislatures of 20 states and have become the law in Oklahoma. Joining us now is Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office, and he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement who served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael German.
Thanks for having me.
And today in New York, FBI agents essentially raided the hotel room of Michael Cohen, the lawyer for a private personal lawyer of Donald Trump's, at the Loews Regency Hotel on Park Avenue. And according to a statement from Michael Cohen's lawyer, Stephen Ryan, he says, today the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York executed a series of search warrants and seized the privileged communications between my client, Michael Cohen, and his clients. I have been advised by federal prosecutors that the New York action is, in part, a referral by the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. So what do you make of that, Michael German?
So it's not terribly unusual for an independent counsel or special counsel investigation to develop evidence that's not quite within its mandate. So it refers that out to the broader FBI. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that even though there's a special counsel, it's still FBI agents who are doing the investigation, and they communicate with the FBI. So this isn't typically, it isn't terribly unusual. Obviously, it's a little unusual that the president's personal lawyer is the subject of that search warrant. And when law enforcement does a search of a lawyer's residence or office, they have to be quite careful to make sure they segregate any information that might be confidential under the lawyer-client privilege, so that there could be a privilege team that will look over the records to determine what can be used as part of an investigation and what can't be.
Well, it was only a few days ago that President Trump on Air Force One for the first time answered questions about Stormy Daniels and the $130,000 that Michael Cohen paid her just a week before the elections, which has become a contentious issue on its own. And the president's remarks essentially were, well, I know nothing about it, and you have to talk to Michael Cohen. Well, it sure looks like somebody's talking to Michael Cohen, right? And I'm not sure it's entirely about Stormy Daniels or even partially about her, but it's almost like the president set this one up.
Well, and certainly the public comments that that Mr. Cohen himself has made about the payments, I think, have raised certain questions and may have drawn attention to matters that they had not intended to draw attention to. So that may be where this is generated, but my guess is there was also other information that that justified this kind of aggressive posture. In other words, that they had some reason to believe that a subpoena would not be sufficient to secure the evidence they were looking for.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael German, who is a former FBI special agent, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Well, already the Steele dossier, which so far has not been discredited, in many cases has been verified, does mention Michael Cohen and points to an alleged important meeting that took place in Prague, which Michael Cohen has denied. So what's your hunch here, Michael German, given that the referral came from Special Counsel Mueller? What do you think Mueller's looking for in terms of seizing these personal communications, which I assume means computers, laptops, iPads, iPhones, and files?
So I don't know that I'm very good at that kind of guesswork, but I would suggest that there is probably pretty specific information that they're looking for that they have either attempted to subpoena or otherwise have come across criminal activity not directly related to the special counsel's investigation that they turned over to the New York U.S. Attorney or the New York office of the FBI to pursue an independent investigation.
Well, there are suggestions that it's in part related to the Stormy Daniels situation. The latest, of course, this has been sort of tabloid fodder, if you will, that's ended up in a frenzied way on cable television. The lawyer for Stormy Daniels, Michael Avenatti, has made a number of appearances, and he does in many ways seem to be sort of out-lawyering Michael Cohen. But now his latest volley against Michael Cohen is to do with an allegation that Stormy Daniels was sort of warned by some kind of mafia-type guy in a parking lot in Las Vegas to lay off President Trump, and that Avenatti was going to present a composite drawing of who this person was. What's your sense of whether there's a connection here? Because the reporting, even though it's sketchy since this just happened today, indicates that it's in part this raid is related to Stormy Daniels. So what do you think they could find that would be useful to Avenatti and his case?
Right. Well, I do think the line that this is in part a result of a referral from the special counsel suggests that there were other investigations going on as well, or other investigative interests that the FBI had. So I think, unfortunately, we'll just have to wait and see what the scope of their search warrant was, but you know, certainly when you're talking about money changing hands between parties and the kind of public disclosure of that, I would think that for a variety of reasons, a lot of different investigators' ears are going to perk up, if nothing else, for tax violations or perhaps some election law violations. There are all sorts of possibilities when you see that kind of money being advanced for reasons that aren't necessarily completely legitimate, like hush money.
Right. I guess that it's sort of at the point of absurdity where we're expected to believe that people sort of randomly take a second mortgage on the house to pay $130,000 to somebody for reasons that are completely unclear, right? I mean, it's an amazing situation that the money was paid and yet there's a denial that there's any purpose behind it. I mean,
Right. I mean, the whole situation is quite unusual and, you know, typically where, you know, once you start peeling the onion, often there's other kinds of activities that the investigators find. And again, because this appears to be done by the New York FBI rather than the special counsel's contingent, I would imagine that there are issues broader than just the matters that fall within the mandate of the special counsel.
Well, according to the New York Times, you know, along with going to the room at the Loews Regency Hotel where apparently Michael Cohen was staying, they also raided his office. And just quote from the New York Times, FBI officials took emails, tax documents, and business records, a person briefed on the raid told the New York Times. So I guess the only other case in terms of what Mueller has done so far that would be similar would be the raids on Manafort, wouldn't it? I mean, most of other people have been subpoenaed and had to testify before the grand jury, but this is the only other raid by the FBI that I'm aware of.
Which in and of itself was quite unusual. I mean, typically when in a white-collar crime investigation, the government tends to work through subpoenas and voluntary compliance. And really, in most cases, there has to be some basis to have believed that that the person was not complying with the subpoenas, or there was a chance of evidence being destroyed that would compel the FBI to act more aggressively with a search warrant. But clearly, they got the search warrant through a judge, so there is some independent review of the probable cause, which would bolster their justification for having initiated the search. And as I suggested, typically when the FBI is searching a lawyer's office, they have to be concerned about lawyer-client privilege and therefore would set up a privilege team to go through the records first and make sure they're not looking make sure the investigators don't get access to confidential information.
Well, we already know, for example, that there's a couple of key people that are talking to Mueller. Rick Gates, the deputy of Manafort, and he apparently knows quite a lot. At least that's the suggestion that we hear. And also this other extraordinary character, George Nader, he's been before the grand jury four times now. Amazing to think that a secret interlocutor formerly convicted of child molestation and possession of child pornography. That in itself makes me wonder why anybody would use a guy like that as a secret envoy. But it looks as if he's now caught Eric Prince in a perjury and testified against him. So is that what Mueller's up to here, that, you know, that all these people are sort of covering up for themselves and lying about other things, like the first guy that they nailed, the Dutch lawyer, basically lying about a communication he had with a guy that looks as if he was a former GRU Russian intelligence officer who happened to be Paul Manafort's deputy in Ukraine.
Yeah, certainly, and working your way up. I mean, one of the problems when witnesses don't tell the truth is how you deal with that, and obviously it creates a separate crime. So perhaps having them plead guilty to making false statements at least acknowledges that those statements were indeed false and were so false that the person is willing to plead guilty to a federal crime sort of addresses that false statement, so that when they tell a different statement in court, it's very clear that their previous statement was the false statement. But it's problematic because you're basically starting from the premise that your witness is a liar. So, whatever documentary evidence they can get to substantiate the true version of the facts, I think, are critical, which is why investigators tend to be concerned when there are documents they may have a pretty good reason to know exist that aren't being turned over when a witness is subpoenaed, and the necessity to go and get those records rather than risk them being destroyed becomes compelling.
Well, Michael German, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael German, who's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. And previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office. And he was a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, serving as a special agent with the FBI, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. We can take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's promise that within 48 hours, those behind the chemical attacks in Syria will have a big price to pay. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Beirut, Lebanon, is Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. Welcome to Background Briefing. Thanasi Kambanis.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
Well, thank you, and I wish we had better things to talk about, but since you're right next door to Syria and Israeli missiles rained down on an airfield, which the Russian Air Force had used, I'm not sure whether they had any planes at the time, and of course, prior to that, there was the use of chlorine gas, it would seem, against civilians in Syria, which has prompted the President of the United States, Donald Trump, to refer to Assad as Animal Assad and threaten something big. So what's the feeling in the neighborhood? Do they feel that something big is about to happen?
Well, there's a real feeling of deja vu. I mean, it's uncanny how precisely this script is playing out a year, exactly a year, since the same thing happened in Khan Sheikhoun. There was a chemical weapons strike. There was outrage. Eventually, Donald Trump sent Tomahawk missiles against a Syrian base. And briefly, there was a sort of flaring concern about whether this would turn into that wider regional war that everyone's looking out for. So it's bizarre in a way to see, I think 11 months and 363 days later, the regime appearing to use chemical weapons again, almost as if it's determined to prove that there are no red lines and that the chemical weapons taboo means nothing, and in a sense determined to cement the unassailable position that the Syrian regime and its Russian and Iranian backers feel like they've secured with their victory in Syria. Now the real worry, I mean, everyone I've spoken to, including myself, is worried as always about the potential for a miscalculation. But there's also a lot of sense of in a way, in inertia in favor of more of the same. So there's a sort of awful status quo, but that status quo isn't a huge burning regional war. And the feeling, the sort of weary resignation that I hear a lot of is that even among people who would like to see some kind of real, hard, meaningful response against the regime for this, the general feeling is that what we're going to see is more of the kind of ping pong back and forth volleys of strikes involving all these different parties, and that it won't lead to anything more. But I'm not so sure. And I guess we'll talk about this. What are the risks and what are the possibilities of America hitting hard and of Russia then hitting back?
Well, Trump tweeted out criticism of Putin for the first time ever on Sunday. And today, in a photo op, he said that when asked about Vladimir Putin's responsibility, which, of course, he tweeted about yesterday, for the chemical weapon attack and for Assad, the animal's behavior, the president said, talking about Putin, he may, in other words, bear responsibility. And if he does, it's going to be very tough, very tough. Everybody's going to pay a price. He will. Everybody will. So Trump is talking tough. Now, as you point out, he did fire, I think it was ended up about 57 Tomahawk cruise missiles. And a lot of it, of course, was couched in criticism of Obama, which is an absolute ritual with Trump. You know, in other words, Obama caved on his red line, but I'm not going to do the same. So is that what's motivating him in your mind? I mean, a week ago he's wanting to pull out of Syria altogether, and now he's wanting to deepen the engagement, it would seem. So I imagine.
Well, so one thing is clear to me, which is that he doesn't have or have an interest in a real sustained engaged Middle East policy, period. So whether we're talking about ISIS, Iraq, Syria, or any of the wider questions in play, Trump has not shown any interest in having a policy. And that's sort of the bedrock concern of whatever happens in the next week, is that it will not be embedded in some kind of consistent policy, even a bad policy, right? But some kind of premeditated, thought out policy context. So that's part of the problem here. No matter what Trump does this week, in terms of pulling out of Eastern Syria or in terms of responding in Western Syria to the chemical weapons, it won't be accompanied with a kind of follow-through, diplomatic, military, whatever, that would be necessary to have a meaningful policy. Now, that said, Trump seems to have a real interest in not looking weak, okay? And he also seems to have a real consistent interest in not being involved. So these are the sort of running common themes. You know, as soon as ISIS retreated from its major strongholds in Syria and Iraq, he's spoken in public about getting American troops out of there as soon as possible, even if the advice is they should stay involved in order to prevent a resurgence of ISIS. So he wants to get out and not be involved in any kind of long-running ground war. And at the same time, he wants to look tough. Now, my sense is he cares more about optics than substance, and that's what we saw in play a year ago during that strike after the Khan Sheikhoun chemical attack. A lot of Syrian interventionists, and frankly a lot of Syrians who've been suffering under the regime, hoped that that was going to be the opening salvo in some kind of intervention or even some kind of sustained campaign to pressure the Syrian regime or the Russians to be less murderous, or even just a sustained involvement to make it harder for the regime to kill civilians. But in fact, it was followed by nothing. Almost complete silence on the main front in the Syrian war, and one of the tests that this event raises, which I think is very interesting, is what happens when Trump starts to feel like he's being made to look like a patsy by Putin, and not just in Syria, but globally. You know, he's supposed to be the most powerful leader in the world, and Putin is running circles around him, and in the case of this chemical weapons attack, is showing that Russia can act with impunity, can do what it wants, can lie with impunity, and the U.S. won't do anything. And I think that will gall Trump, and maybe you can reduce this to playground psychology, or you can think of it in terms of sort of Cold War superpower psychology, which maybe is the same thing. But I think Trump will be very tempted to take some kind of action, not because he cares about Syria per se, and maybe not even because he cares about the chemical weapons taboo, although there's hints that he does, but that he'll be interested in taking action because he will want to be the alpha leader on the world stage and not allow Putin to make him look indecisive or vulnerable. And that's what makes this, I think, a very interesting and possibly very dangerous moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, who is in Beirut. He writes the international column for the Boston Globe, is a contributor to foreign policy and a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. And his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. So let's touch on the Israeli missile attack on the Syrian air base, which I mentioned Russian planes had used, but apparently Hezbollah was there occupying that Syrian base. Some of them were killed. My understanding is that Prime Minister Netanyahu was absolutely dumbstruck when Trump announced that he wanted to get out, because there's only 2,000 American special forces there working with the Kurds, but they're sitting in a very strategic position. They occupy Assad's oil fields, which he wants back. They sit astride what would be the ground route between Tehran and Damascus. And, they recently were attacked by the 5th Corps, including a bunch of Russian mercenaries from the Wagner's Brigade, who were wiped out by a U.S. airstrike. And very little was said about it on the Russian side. But the U.S. commander there, with only 2,000 men, is very nervous about the fact that 2 miles away, there are heavy armor columns of Russians, Iranians, and Syrians. So it's a hair-trigger situation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly comparable to what the situation on the DMZ in Korea, but when you put U.S. troops in a place like that, they serve essentially as a tripwire and a guarantor. The strategic calculation is that none of these parties are going to intentionally attack and kill these Americans, because they know that even if they could overrun the enclave or cause great damage in the short term, that the overwhelming might of the Americans would then be called into play, and so they're sort of required to leave them alone. And this is the sort of yielding that U.S. policy has done wave after wave, and it's begun under Obama, which is essentially the own goals of giving up relatively safe strategic investment. So in the case of this enclave in eastern Syria, it's problematic. It irritates the U.S. allies in Turkey. It's dangerous, as you mentioned, because of the nearness of the Russians. At the same time, the U.S. doesn't owe any of these people that are bothered by it any kind of particular deference. These are recalcitrant allies and problematic enemies that routinely lie and murder civilians. And so the logical move is to either keep those assets in place as part of a stabilized and counter ISIS strategy, or give them up in exchange for something. And instead, what we've done repeatedly, or the U.S. has done, and when I say we, the West widely has done repeatedly, is just give up leverage over Russia, over Assad, over Iran in exchange for nothing. And that is a real shame, because we see in the chemical weapons attacks and other atrocities the lesson learned by this kind of retreat. If the West creates a vacuum and either rewards misbehavior like it did with the chemical weapons deal in 2013 or simply turns away, as it has with the ongoing barrages of barrel bombs and other and just conventional bombing against civilians, the architects of these war criminal strategies learn that it works. And I think what we see in Syria today all over is the result of that sort of set of rewards and a correct cost-benefit analysis, where players like Bashar al-Assad and Vladimir Putin and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps calculate correctly that they can press their advantage and do what they will, and eventually the U.S. and others will retreat and leave Syria and maybe Iraq and down the road other places to them to operate in freely.
But Tanasi Kambanis, when you say the U.S. doesn't owe anything, they certainly owe something to the Kurds, it would seem, who have been the only reliable boots on the ground. They've been their allies. And if they abandon the Kurds and pull out, as Trump wanted to do only a week ago, the Kurds would be slaughtered by a combination of the Turks, the Iranians, the Russians, and the Syrians.
I mean, on a moral level, of course, the U.S. owes its local allies and foot soldiers sort of decent treatment. In terms of America's priorities, those priorities have to be based on America's national interest. One of the things that is frustrating is that people act like the Kurds and the SDF are somehow miracle fighters who did something that others, including Arabs, couldn't do. And the fact is that for years and years, all the way up till the emergence of the SDF, America refused to give air cover to its Arab proxies and allies in Syria. So those militias never had forward air support and the kind of fighter bomber support that Americans gave the SDF. So then the SDF did really well under American air cover. And we saw in Afrin, when that air cover was absent, their city fell to the Turks in, I think, 3 days. So that gives you a sense of how strong the SDF is. It's really the U.S. air assets that made it strong, and that's a strength that the U.S. could have given someone else. And that was one of the dumb, unforced errors in U.S. strategy, where the U.S. refused to meaningfully help any of its sort of palatable mainstream Arab allies, and eventually gave that kind of support to a persona non grata Kurdish group that is listed as a terrorist group by NATO ally Turkey, in a move that was guaranteed, even at its inception, to lead to the impasse we're in today. So, you know, like you say, there's something important in doing right by those fighters on a human level, but in terms of strategy and national interest, the U.S. can't build an enduring strategy in Syria or in Syria and Iraq on this particular widely detested and very problematic Kurdish faction. And that speaks to the wider incoherence of U.S. strategy and to the wider concerns that I think we'll still be talking about weeks or months after this week's crisis hopefully passes. We'll still be in a worrisome strategic drift in a place where ISIS will be resurging, where Assad will be murdering civilians, and he'll be preparing to kill or target the millions who are now hiding, or not hiding, but surviving in Idlib province. And maybe they'll start turning their eyes on the Israeli border or on destabilizing Lebanon. And this overreach will continue until someone stands up to the bullying and the lying and the murdering that Syria and Iran and Russia have gotten up to. And it's not to say that the other sides are morally pure or necessarily even less criminal in their tactics, but this is a sort of resurgent alliance. It's been on the upswing for almost 10 years, and until they're checked, they'll keep expanding. And that's we're seeing one yet again a test of whether the U.S. and its Western allies have the resolve to stand up.
Well, it's obvious that at least at the time when just only a week ago when Trump, or he actually said it earlier than that, he said it a couple of times that he wanted to pull out. He signaled in a rally in Ohio that he wanted to pull out, and that alarmed. I mean, it felt to a lot of experts and military experts over here as strategic malpractice to give up that chip for nothing. And clearly the Israelis weighed in. I mean, Netanyahu is alarmed at the idea that the U.S. would just pull out and give up. As I say, they're sitting there astride that land route between Damascus and Tehran, which obviously worries the Israelis. So given suspicions about Trump's loyalties and deference to Putin, it seems to me like, on the one hand, Trump's trying to please Putin, at least up until this latest gas attack. But on the other hand, Netanyahu's whispering in his ear saying, for God's sake, you're crazy to pull those 2,000 special forces out and allow ISIS to come back, the Kurds to be slaughtered, and lose any bargaining chips for
And let's throw two other things into the mix. One is Iraq, where I just was a few weeks ago, where there's been a successful pushback against ISIS, but ISIS is still strong, and the Iraqis are justifiably still worried about ISIS regrouping and coming back. And no one in their right mind would suggest that the U.S. should give up the role that it's developed very successfully in the last 3 years, cooperating with Iraqis to fight ISIS. But Trump wants to get out of there, and that's terrifying just from a national security standpoint, because ISIS is still strong in Syria and Iraq, and it's going to require the same coalition that got it out of Raqqa and Mosul to keep on going. The second factor, which we haven't talked about, and maybe we don't want to because it's so terrifying, is John Bolton, who just showed up on his first day of work today, and has been, is a man who never met a war he didn't like, and he has his own, I think, very dangerous ideas about what should be done in the Middle East. And there's an opportunity here for him to use, let's say, Trump's frustration with Putin or Trump's sense of humiliation about chemical weapons to more nefarious ends, where Bolton might like to see war with Iran, wars on behalf of Israeli interests that don't align with American interests. And that's just another wild card which makes me nervous.
Well, apparently the person who leaned on Trump to hire Bolton was Adelson, the casino owner. So he's also, and he was, who along with Mercer was the biggest donor to Trump. So you have all these influences, and I mentioned, I'm sure Netanyahu's weighing in too. So just to sum up here, obviously Netanyahu and the Israelis are dealing with the Russians, but at some point or other, Iranian influence in Syria is obviously growing, and that seems to be on a collision course. I can't imagine the Israelis want the Revolutionary Guard Corps on the Golan Heights. So it seems to me that there's going to be a big clash at some point or other, even if this one's only a minor.
Well, let's say there doesn't necessarily have to be a big clash, because if artfully managed, it could be a pushback without being a big clash. But yes, I agree that ultimately, it would be bizarre for the United States not to respond at some point. So the United States left a big vacuum. It's been filled by Russia and Iran and Hezbollah and others, and it's been filled in spaces that that very many of America's friends don't want to see ceded to the alliance of Putin and Hezbollah and Khamenei and Assad. And so, yes, the question is how can the U.S. push back, short of, let's say, starting some kind of regional war? And that's where I'd like to see, even if I don't agree with its details and all its contours, I'd like to see a U.S. strategy, a sort of a grand set of responses that says, okay, here are the things that the U.S. won't accept, whether it's use of chemical weapons against civilians, whether it's the expansion of Russia's sphere of influence into countries beyond Syria's borders, or whatever limits it wants to draw. They can, in a sense, be arbitrary, but it has to set some kind of limits and then enforce them. And it can do that in many ways, short of war or military force. But the U.S. has to be meaningfully committed to doing it, and that's the kind of policy making we haven't seen much of from Trump. And to be fair, Obama tried to do some kinds of policy making like this and failed dramatically. So even to the extent that a supposedly more, let's say, engaged and detail-oriented president wanted to accomplish this in the last administration, he completely failed. So it's not easy to get it right, even if you want to. But that is what has to happen, because otherwise what we'll see is a further spread of these very destabilizing norms and a kind of hegemony of Machiavellian opportunists, and a real, I think, a contested balance of power in the region that's going to lead to more ISIS-like phenomena and more of the kinds of fighting that we've already seen in Libya, Yemen, and Syria and Iraq. So I hope that we're going to get the beginnings of some kind of coherent policy that will at least march us back towards an equilibrium.
Well, just in closing, the idea of getting it right when you've got an ignoramus in the White House who is under some kind of sway of Putin. We don't understand that entirely. Maybe the Mueller investigation will answer those lingering questions about Trump's basic loyalty to the United States. And then, he's heavily influenced by right-wing donors to Israel like Adelson, and he's certainly influenced by Netanyahu. And he's just hired a warmonger as his right-hand man. So I'm not holding my breath that the U.S. is going to get it right.
I think you're wise on that front.
All right. Well, I thank you for joining us, Thanasi.
All right. Take care, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, who is in Beirut. He writes the International's column for the Boston Globe, is a contributor to foreign policy, and a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Allegiance and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the state legislature in Iowa just passed a law criminalizing peaceful protests against oil and gas pipelines.
There's a woman on my block. She just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused. Sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, and it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand, or just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeff Biggers, an award-winning journalist, historian, and playwright presently based in Iowa. He's the author of The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek. And his forthcoming book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Iowa's anti-protest bill would make the Boston Tea Partiers felons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks for having me back on, Ian.
And thanks for joining us. And this is an alarming bill that the Iowa State Legislature just passed. It makes it a felony punishable by up to 25 years in jail for any unauthorized and overt act intended to cause a substantial and widespread interruption or impairment of the fundamental services of gas, oil, and or refined petroleum products. In other words, interrupting pipelines, demonstrating against any of the above. So tell us about what this means, just in translating it in terms of what this means for activists, particularly those concerned about the tar sands coming in from Canada.
Right, Ian. This is really an alarming bill that is passing through Iowa. It's also being discussed in six or seven other states right this week. And across the country, there's similar bills that are being brought into the legislature. The bill is essentially a generic version of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. And that was essentially something conjured by the American Legislative Executive Council, which we probably a lot of your listeners know as ALEC. It's the Koch brothers kind of lobby front for the oil and gas and coal companies, and the extreme right-wing lobby front that comes up with these bills, which then they provide for all the legislatures across the country. And this is simply one of the copycat bills. It's very alarming because what it does is to make a felony out of what has often been considered a very simple misdemeanor or trespassing charge. You know, something as simple as having a protest on the land of a pipeline or a power plant or anywhere near oil or petroleum products. And so essentially what they're doing is upping the ante to 25 years in prison. And it's clearly to send or to create this atmosphere of fear for anybody who wants to protest or keep up the American tradition of dissent. especially in an age of Trump.
Well, already Oklahoma has pushed through this Alec Koch brothers bill, has it not?
Exactly. They were the first person, the first state to pass it, and that was last summer. And the ACLU, in fact, warned us last summer, hey, there's 20 states who are considering us. I think it largely why it's very important here in the Midwest and other states is that there's still a very thriving anti-pipeline movement happening. You know, just this week in Louisiana, you had many people arrested trying to stop pipeline developments down there in the Gulf. And we're still seeing, you know, leaks and all sorts of problems with the pipelines that are coming through both Standing Rock and then through the Midwest down to the Mississippi River. Meanwhile, you have the other hand of this, Ian, and that's in Boston last week. There was really a potentially a landmark ruling. And in the district court judge, she ruled in favor of anti-pipeline activists who were arrested for a similar charge that went on to private property of the pipeline company, and they were arrested. And she ruled in favor of the climate necessity defense, which basically says the harms of climate change are reasonable justification for citizens to engage in disruptive protests. So on one hand, you have a landmark ruling in favor of people who are now taking on pipelines and all sorts of disruptors of climate change versus now these new state bills, which are turning it into a felony.
Well, there's also an ongoing demonstration right next to the Appalachian Trail where a pipeline is going to be a gas pipeline from the fracking that's going on in Pennsylvania to take the gas into the coast, the East Coast, through the Appalachian Trail, which is quite sacred to a lot of people, particularly in those that like to hike and experience nature, and that protesters there are being very creative and very brave. So this is something that's going on across this country, and the idea that it could be criminalized with a stroke of a pen and that they're quietly moving forward to do this in all of these Republican-controlled legislatures is alarming. Why do you think it hasn't gotten the attention? I mean, the ACLU, as you mentioned, are on board, but, you know, frankly, until I read your article, Jeff, I hadn't really heard about this.
Well, I think it's simply because we're dealing with so many struggles on so many fronts and so many headline issues, and I certainly don't need to tell you about that. I mean, here, for example, in Iowa, we have a right-wing legislature and governor who've also passed some other very egregious bills that are taking a lot of our time, both against collective bargaining and labor unions, against the teachers, against the sanctuary cities. It's just one after another. And so I think this is one bill that kind of fell through the cracks because simply we're dealing with so many issues on so many different fronts. Now, there was one little blip of good news. Last month in Wyoming, a similar bill passed through their legislature, and the Republican governor, Matt Mead, actually vetoed the bill. His way of dealing with it was saying, hey, we need more public input. And so I feel like if a state like Wyoming, which obviously is a powerhouse in terms of fossil fuels and gas and oil and coal, can veto such a bill through a Republican, that there might be a glimmer of hope if we shine more attention on the matter, that people actually can get back to the legislatures and say these kind of bills need to be thrown out.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Biggers, who's an award-winning journalist, historian, and playwright presently based in Iowa. He's the author of The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and his forthcoming book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. And he has an op-ed at the Huffington Post, Iowa's anti-protest bill would make the Boston Tea Party as felons. And of course, the point of your title is that there is an American tradition. In fact, the country was founded on rebellion and protest, and to criminalize it would make President Adams turn over in his grave, not to mention Jefferson and all of the other founding fathers. But when you talk about how these Republican legislatures are getting away with all kinds of right-wing outrages at the behest of the Koch brothers and other right-wing plutocrats who basically own these legislators. They're cheap to buy them in states. They're more expensive at the federal level, but the Kochs have tons of money. But there's pushback going on, though. It's palpable. You've seen the teachers in West Virginia and in Kentucky and in Oklahoma. In fact, they're still striking in Oklahoma. So there are reasons to feel that the right-wing plutocrats and their whores and hirelings in state legislatures have gone too far.
Oh, I would agree with you 100%. In fact, what I tried to do was to give an example of how this bill in Iowa would really crack down on anti-pipeline protesters in an absurd way. A very active group here in terms of the pushback with the pipeline, you know, which didn't, the DAPL pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, obviously went through Standing Rock in South Dakota, but I think a lot of people forgot it also came all the way across the state of Iowa, displaced a lot of farmers, and there was a lot of opposition to it. A very respectable group called the 100 Grannies. It's a group of older women who have been on the forefront of protesting, did a wonderful nonviolent protest last in the year 2016, right before the election, where they went on to pipeline property to draw attention of the proximity to the Mississippi River. And they essentially took their case to court, and it was thrown out by the judge for trespassing charges. Basically, the prosecutor and the judge, they refused even to take this case to trial. That similar case of nonviolent resistance, of trespassing on pipeline property, now would be treated as a Class B felony, and these 100 grannies would be facing, 25 years in prison. And I think for Midwesterners and people in Iowa, this is the kind of shameless, ALEC-type bill that really has no place in the state legislature. And I think by putting some light on the absurdities of it and the extreme element of these bills, I think there is going to be that kind of pushback against both ALEC and the tendencies of these right-wing legislatures. I'm fairly hopeful, to be honest with you.
Well, obviously there'll be court challenges, and again, this is what's so scary about what Trump is doing, stacking the courts with these right-wing federal judges and the Supreme Court too, with all these corporatists like Neil Gorsuch. So It's not just that the Kochs are buying the legislatures and getting these outrageous bills to criminalize civil disobedience and protest. They're also pushing to have these corporatists to change the very laws to their favors. On top of it, by the way, they're backing a move to have another constitutional convention, a convention of the states, as it's called, where all they need is two-thirds of the states, and already they're within a couple of two or three states of reaching that critical mass where they could open up a constitutional convention and completely rewrite the American Constitution to the liking of the Koch brothers. So there's an awful lot of fronts to be fighting on here, because these multi-billionaires that have got $100 billion to invest in politics are very active. But just in the last few minutes, I'd like to learn more about what the judge ruled in the case that you mentioned in favor of the protesters, on the basis of the fact that the protesters are protesting in defense of the planet, in defense of preserving our planet from the dangers and the growing destruction of climate change.
Right. This was, once again, a potentially landmark ruling. It also happened in 2016. It was 13 defendants there in the West Rockville area who, once again, were protesting.
Can you pick that up again? The protesters in the what? The phone dropped out.
I'm sorry, in the Boston area.
Just go back a little bit. 100 protesters.
There were 13 defendants in the Boston area who were arrested in 2016 for a similar gas pipeline protest. What's notable is some of those protesters included some fairly notable people in the religious community, people like Tim DeChristopher, who went to prison for 2 years with his protests in Utah against the development of lands for oil exploration there, as well as Al Gore's daughter. What's important is that the judge allowed all 13 defendants this winter to testify on why they felt there was a necessity defense for trespassing against the pipeline. And, of course, they brought up the necessity defense that climate change, in fact, was a reasonable justification for engaging in disruptive protests. What's important is the judge heard them out and then made the decision to move the criminal charges that had been brought against them to a single civil infraction, the equivalent of a parking ticket or whatnot. And ultimately, it was thrown out. And therefore, she essentially was acquitting these people who had actually gone to trial using the necessity defense. And so I think this ruling is going to be very important on a national level, almost as important as the statewide bills. Obviously, we're going to have a collision here between state and federal decisions. But I think this is something that's very important that we, once again, need to keep shining a light on to pass the words in other states.
Well, just in closing, what about the so-called blue wave? Do you think there will be a change in these state legislatures and that Democrats will take over, and both at in terms of governorships and the legislatures?
I'm fairly hopeful. I'm right here on the border of Iowa and Illinois, and as you know, I've done a lot of work, and originally am from Illinois. There you have a very close race between Governor Rauner, a billionaire, of course, who's led the state in an almost economic ruin. He refused to sign a budget for 2 years. He did an extraordinarily number of errors, both in terms of environmental protection and whatnot. He's running against another billionaire named Pritzker, who got the Democratic nomination, who's taking a centrist route, who appears to be ahead in the polls. And so Illinois hopefully will reclaim the governorship that they lost a few years ago. Meanwhile, in Iowa, we have this governor who's never been elected. Her name is Kim Reynolds. She became the governor of Iowa, of course, when Terry Branstad, the longtime governor, was appointed ambassador to China under Trump. And just this past week, of course, we see in the national news, Iowans who went with Trump in the last election are bearing a huge burden in terms of this potential trade war with China. The products specifically that have been targeted by the Chinese in retaliation, of course, are pork and soybeans and corn, the very products that generate much of the economy for the governor. So once again, there's the tide can shift dramatically, both because of the excessiveness and the incredible ways in which Trump is moving the country. And at the same time, I think there's definitely a movement for the Democrats to retain the governorship here in Iowa. So I think it's going to be a very interesting moment this fall, Ian, but I think things like this bill are really putting it out in front of everybody of, are we willing for the state to go even further right, or are the people in these states wanting to, you know, to realize the extremism that these bills represent and want to go back to more of a moderate centrist approach.
Well, Jeff Biggers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Biggers, who's an award-winning journalist, historian, and playwright, presently based in Iowa. He's the author of The United States of Appalachia, State Out of the Union, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek. And his forthcoming book is Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Iowa's Anti-Protest Bill Would Make the Boston Tea Party as Felons. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.